You belong. Say that every morning in the mirror to yourself. You belong. You can step up. Believe in yourself. Be bold. Look at programs, find connections, work hard, believe you can do it. We all have a unique role in leadership roles to help open doors for others. If we had to wait longer for us to get doors open, that's not an excuse.
Hello, everyone. This is the Responsible Luxury Podcast, the show where we cut through the noise and talk about what really matters for the future of business. I'm your host, Lauren Petrovic. If you're leading a company, building a brand, or investing in the future of luxury, you already know the rules have changed. Today, it's about trust, accountability, and how we show up as leaders. My guest today, Iris van der Wieken, has been driving that change for decades. As executive director of the Watches and Jewelry Initiative 2030, she's working with the world's most iconic brands to tackle climate, inclusivity, and transparency head on. In this conversation, we get into the real playbook of modern leadership. We'll talk about trust as the new currency, how to turn sustainability into business resilience, and why luxury has the power to set the standard for every other industry. So wherever you're listening today, whether you're a business leader, a creative, or someone searching for deeper meaning in your work, this is a conversation you don't want to miss. Yes, this is a conversation about business, but it's also about the human spirit and how we together can build a future worthy of generations to come. So let's get right into it. Hi, Iris. Welcome to the Responsible Luxury Podcast. How are you?
Hi, Lauren. Well, I'm quite happy because we're almost at a summer break. So it's a good moment to have this conversation.
Yes, it is indeed. It's always nice to take a step back and pause for a bit and reflect on the last year. It's been some time since I last saw you because the first time I've met you was during Climate Week at our dinner. And the energy and the grace and the elegance you bring into the room is always something that I admired so deeply about you. And I'm excited to talk with you today and share your journey with our listeners today.
Thanks, Lauren. Thank you very much. I'm really happy.
Are you? You're based in Geneva.
Yes, indeed. I'm based in Geneva. So I'm actually Belgian. I come from a small town between Antwerp and Ghent, and I'm based in Geneva now.
So I want to kick off our conversation today. I see you as this incredible leader, and I know behind every visionary is a fascinating personal journey. So I want to start right there and start by asking you where your early experiences, perhaps early childhood.
Thanks, Lauren. Leadership is an evolution, right? Like you rightly say, it's a journey. And so if I share a little bit about my background, I come from a very traditional family. My father and my mother, they're both 80 now. Imagine 60 years together. So I come from a very protective home with a younger brother, Nicholas, 5 years younger. And actually, my parents embedded core principles of life. And I think one of them, Lauren, which I think is important for leadership, is dedication, discipline, and hard work. I always say results just don't fall out of the sky. I think preparation is everything, discipline and hard work. Do your best, be kind, be respectful, be inclusive. One principle my father stood very firm on was humility is key. So if my brother and I would get too excited or we felt a little bit high in the sky, he would put us down at our 2 feet, probably literally sometimes, and say, Nicholas and Iris, please, behave. Humility is important. And I think those are characteristics that are actually really important in leadership and are becoming more important, Lauren. If I look at traditional leadership where you would have a boss, right, where you would, potentially listen and you execute, and you are almost sometimes afraid to stand up or give your views. For me, that traditional model is luckily that's the end. I think we're in a very new era where it is critical as a leader to have empathic skill sets, show empathy, and to show you want your team to grow. I always say there are many stars in the sky, right, Lauren? So if you want to shine, you need to shine together. So I think that that approach of being a more inclusive leader, be open-minded, listen to the young voices. I think the beauty today is that leadership is not so much about hierarchy. Of course, it's important. You will always have somebody who's finally accountable, and you will have the CEO, and you will have across the business functions, you will have the executive leadership team. But it could be that a bright young mind or someone junior with 2-3 years of experience brings you the most marvelous idea. So that also shows leadership and openness. And I think that's something throughout my pathway that I've learned from bad leaders and bad bosses, I would say. But luckily, I had the privilege to work also for a lot of fantastic people. It's very important to see that you surround yourself by smart and beautiful brains that are actually smarter than you. And I think the collective intelligence and the kindness and then moving that team to the next level, that's when you get the most better results.
Most of the people around you. Highlighting what you said, leaders, one of the biggest responsibilities is creating that ecosystem for people to have intellectual and emotional safety to share ideas. Everyone feels open and wanting to help build and create inside of this ecosystem.
And I believe for our industry, because we are such an industry of, you know, of creativity, of beauty, of emotions, I always say we're very lucky to work in the industry we work in, because every day we wake up and we see beautiful things. For our industry, it's important because we are built on creativity, so we need craftsmanship, young talent to believe in our industry. We need new thinking. We need innovation. We need circular thinking. We need so many different skill sets to be able to deliver that trust and that dream to the consumer that is super important for the future of our industry. I love the word trust because trust is a new currency. It's a currency to our consumer, right? Because if tomorrow the consumer does not believe in jewelry or watches, we are not an industry 100%. Of necessity. So I think and I think that's where it's so important that trust is built on responsibility. And responsibility is something you can only do collective as an industry, but also as individuals and a team. And so I always say to the team also, you know, what do I want from you? And then I always say, look, we need to perform, you know, otherwise if we don't have results and profitability, that there is no sustainability. But for me, it's also about that accountability, that collective accountability, that individual accountability, that element of engagement and Lauren engagement within the team, but also multi-stakeholder engagement. I think it's super important to listen to other voices. And that shows, again, humility, because we can think we are right. But it's super important sometimes always to say, okay, this is where I am. This is my proposed plan. This is the solution. But, you know, does civil society find that this is the solution? Does the academic world have more innovative thinking? Do other organizations maybe have built bridges that we should build on?
Seeing which stakeholders, which actors that you're able to bring together inside of this coalition. I'm definitely going to get into that with your role at Watches and Jewelry Initiative.
Yeah, I think all those components make you can be together successful, because no leader can be individual successful. And I think that's also something probably, Lauren, that I learned on that pathway, because leadership is an evolution. At the beginning of my career, you want to prove yourself in an environment. I think I learned a lot from, you know, Iris, come down, you're sitting on a train and you need to see that all the wagons stay connected. You can't just fly out there. You need to see the train moves and everybody still is on the same train and goes into the right direction. And that takes more patience, that takes more time, that takes more consultation and engagement. And I think that's something, luckily, I learned over, I'm sure, at the beginning of my career, I was not such a great leader. Yes. I learned over time.
There was something I wanted to mention. I heard earlier this week from someone who was, the formula of trust equals transparency divided by self-interest. I love that, because as a leader, you have your self-interest. You see the end of the tunnel, but you have to keep everyone on the train together, moving forward together. And that's a big part of your role now. Your evolution as a leader is something to commemorate, especially for young leaders entering the industry. It's not only strategy, like you said, it's also an art and learning about people through different challenges. Learn how to do things a little bit different. I want to get into more of your social impact over the years. What planted that seed? Passion inside of you for social justice?
I think, first of all, coming back to my family, and I really am very grateful, Lauren, to have the family I have. I'm also very grateful, you know, when I look at my parents now, that they're still healthy, they're still very active. But I think we talk about principles. I saw my dad running the marathon for New York for Médecins Sans Frontières. So I always saw social engagement in the family, supporting social causes, helping in the community. I started to work with Special Olympics, a topic very close to my heart. I think those are vitamins you get, life vitamins. And I think these are seeds you plant. And I think at the same time, what is also important is a global mindset. In the 80s, so this was really the time, Lauren, that we didn't have yet, and you know, our iPhone, and it was still writing with the postal letters. We moved as a family to Washington, D.C., so I did part of my high school there. My father was working for the International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C., and that actually really has given, how would I say it? It really brought a complete different mindset to me, because I came from a small village, a wonderful small school, a small community, and being there in that international city, right, Washington, D.C., going to an international school, having to do things for the first time, you know, from playing hockey to basketball ball to doing sports that I never had done before. I had to step up for, it was shocking. It was shocking. My younger brother, Nicholas, adjusted very quickly. I was thinking and rethinking, maybe it's a typical woman thing. How am I going to adapt? This is a very new world to me. But I'm grateful that my parents gave me that experience, because another skill set that is critical for a leader is adaptability and agility. And I had to learn to be agile there. And now I'm so happy and I have still fantastic friends in Washington, D.C. Years after university, I went back to Washington, D.C. to do my own thesis at the International Monetary Fund. So the circle was round. My point is, you continuously evolve, because I think you get these inflection points. You meet people that inspire you. You connect the dots. That definitely had a big impression on me.
Tell us a bit how your journey started in the diamond and jewelry space.
Originally, I came from a stock market company, imagine, in technology, part of the human resources and talent acquisition team. It was a fantastic experience. I learned a lot about, you know, what it was to work for a stock market company, reporting, disclosure, yes, transparency, talent acquisition. Learned a lot about structure, data management, importance of managing talent, because this was the moment in time where there was a shortage on talent in technology. Companies were buying away employees. It was actually insane that time. And we had to hire so many people, and I was part of the recruitment team. So I learned how to attract talent, but also how important it is to build a really good culture of purpose. We talked about a safe space for employees to thrive. And I think the big game changer was in early 2000 when I started to work for Rosie Blue. Rosie Blue is one of the leading diamond manufacturing companies in the world, with around, I think, 15,000 people now. And they are really focusing on polishing diamonds, working for many leading brands also. And I think that company, you know, gave me a lot of opportunities. And there I also started as human resources, Lauren. But then I think karma, you know, that De Beers started their programs on social responsibility. So early 2000 with the best practice principles program. And actually the CEO asked who wants to lead that work. And I was a volunteer to do so. I don't even know if there were others that wanted to do it. I probably was the only one. And I started to work on the best practice principles of the De Beers group. This was a very important program for the industry, because this was actually a program where a mining house asked customers to implement social standards into their supply chain. For the first time, clients, companies that were polishing diamonds, had to get audits into their factories, so how they were doing their business. So social audits on health and safety, on human rights, on decent labor, etc. It was a game changer, Lauren. I mean, I was there. It was a really important milestone. I started in Antwerp, went to South Africa, India, Thailand, Sri Lanka, Armenia. And at a certain point, I was globally responsible. I saw the opportunity. If you implement decent standards, this is not about philanthropy. This is really about business resilience. This is about creating a safe ecosystem, a productive ecosystem. It's de-risking, but it's mostly the opportunity to attract your talent, to attract talent, but also to maintain your craftsmanship into your company and see that your operations
That's the most overlooked facets of sustainability also, because it's the people and it's the collaboration standpoint, which you stand for so deeply. And at this time, when you were transitioning from the finance and the tech space into this diamond industry, I mean, I could only imagine, because my first couple of years I remember in the diamond industry, I was just amazed at just the cast of the unique personalities. Transitioning from two totally separate industries, I'm sure you intuitively you started to learn a bit of approach on what it means to look at this entire ecosystem and put together more social responsibility in the code book so they would go to their clients and take a look at how are they operating their business, how are they treating their employees. When it comes to driving real change, not just hitting KPI metrics, what's your approach to doing just that?
What is critical is you need the commitment of your CEO and the board. And if I go back at that time, so you have to imagine this was early 2000. These were very different times, you know. It was just when the Kimberley process was established. Yeah, so early 2000. This was 2001, 2002. So you had actually the Kimberley process was established. Later, you'll have, you know, in 2005, you had the responsible jury counsel that came together. What is important is you need CEO and board commitment. I always say to people when they're asking, you know, I want to change jobs, I would like to do something else. I say, first of all, look at the CEO. Look at the leadership. Do they want this? Are they committed? Are they going to invest in it? One. Two, sustainability is not soft. I don't like the word sustainability. For me, it's about business innovation, and it needs to be across all business function. You can't disconnect the sustainability manager from all functions. Look at procurement, manufacturing, labor practices do I have? What kind of health and safety? What is my environmental impact? What chemicals am I using? What is my water production process? There are so many items that are all connected, and it's just business. It's actually business resilience. So it's super important that you have the commitment from the top, that you are also able to work across business functions and get everyone involved. One of the great learnings I had working almost 12 years in that role was that you need to be inclusive. You need to see that you surround yourself with experts and specialists that know much more on certain domains on the ground and that can be your ambassadors of change. Because, you know, I can be there screaming how much I want this, but if the employees don't feel it, if your head of production actually is not implementing it, it's not going to breed, right? I always say it's like having this poster somewhere to say, okay, we're a company of purpose and these are our values. You have to feel it and see it through actions. And that takes time and patience, Lauren. Something that I never had at the beginning of my career that I learned to have, you need patience. Patience to bring the right people together, to see they can give their view on the process, that it's inclusive and that they can move the needle. Sometimes you'll just have to be firm and say, this is the way we're going to do it, or we're not able to move the needle. You need then, again, the commitment of the CEO and the board to help you move that needle. So for me, that's an unconditional, it's conditio sine qua non, you need that support. And then it's about engagement and about results. Accountability is everything. And I think when I was at Rosie Blue, you know, I came with quite, at that moment, innovative ideas. Today, this is standard practice, but, you know, we were the first one to do GRI. We were the first one to sign the Women Empowerment Principles. We were the first one to be the Global Compact lead member. We were working already with policymakers on the ground, doing public-private partnerships. This was in the middle of 2000. Some people said, this is an activist. You should get her out. She wants too much transparency. And that's why it's so important, you know, that you have that collective movement.
When you had some people saying, oh, this is a threat to the company because ERS is wanting to bring transparency, let clients know what's happening. Did you have people inside advocating for you?
Yes, otherwise you can't succeed, Lauren, and you don't stay over a decade at a company if you wouldn't have that support. So, but I think it's also, it takes time to get that support. And, well, you know, you wanted to focus on leadership and I think it's very important that there's a certain diplomacy and respect at all times. So you will have people who will never support you and who might misbehave, but it doesn't mean you have to misbehave. I think for me, you know, staying respectful and being diplomatic is a principle that is for me non-negotiable. But if I would say tomorrow, if I would see tomorrow that my CEO doesn't support me, yes, then I would leave. Right. It has no sense. You need the commitment of the top. But you also need to take time to engage and to build that ecosystem of trust. If you don't have trust in the company, you will not be able to move the agenda because people have to trust what you do and believe you will create value to the company and that you will not bring the company in higher risk.
That impact and that change really happens when no one's watching. Doing the right thing even when no one's looking or doing the right thing even when your counterparts aren't is more of like an inside game. I wanted to touch on your work with the Office of the Children's Rights Commissioner, Can you share with us a bit about your experience there, perhaps a story that stays with you today?
Well, it was probably one of the most incredible opportunities that I received, in the sense that I was asked by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Belgium to become the chair of the Global Compact for Belgium. The Global Compact is actually the largest sustainability initiative in the world. It was founded in 1999 at the World Economic Forum in Davos by, at that moment, Secretary General Kofi Annan and Georg Kell, who is actually currently in our board. So there's a very big sentiment now to me. So, and it was a really interesting initiative in the sense that, Lauren, they asked for the first time for CEOs to work with the public sector. They asked CEOs to make commitment on the principles of human rights, environment, labor, and anti-corruption, 10 principles. Today is the largest sustainability initiative in the world across industries. So when the country of Belgium asked me to become chair for this initiative, yeah, of course, it was a deep honor, but also big responsibility. And it was an incredible experience because it taught me about collaboration, diplomacy, working with governments, across institutions, yes, the importance of policy and business. And at the same time that we could learn from other industries, because what I sometimes see is everybody's trying to reinvent the wheel. While there are industries that are more advanced, we might be advanced in a certain area. So how can you bring the opportunity of the collective to learn together? In that context, that I was the chair for Belgium, so I learned a lot about different topics. And one topic that always came together across the industries was children's rights and women rights. And it's, you know, this is something really close to my heart, yes, for many different reasons. I also realized if we tackle the topic of women rights as a priority into the business, we're going to actually have double gains, because we're going to see that children, you know, will also have much more opportunity in development and education, and all the data going to that direction. And so it's in that context then that I received the role for the Flanders Commissioner. And there my role was to listen to solutions institutions wanted to propose to the parliament on building bridges towards children's rights. This could be about the fight against poverty, education, development, inclusion. Yeah. There were so many topics, but it taught me a lot about the necessity of collaboration, but so also the urgency,
yeah,
to action.
And Lord, also too, I mean, there's been so many statistics that have shown that women are ultimately the biggest decision makers in the economy, and empowering women empowers the economy and stirs household spending. You're also very, very involved with UN Women, and you've been working with that for many years now. I'd love to hear about the latest initiatives you guys are working on this year and rolling out initiatives for the next couple of years. Can you share with the audience a bit about what the role of UN Women is and perhaps something you guys are most focused on right now?
Yeah, so thank you very much, Lauren. So we have a strategic collaboration since 3 years with UN Women, and we actually have a collaboration in three areas. First, we ask our companies within the initiative to sign the Women Empowerment Principles. These are actually 7 principles that were established in 2010, ask companies to commit to principles in the workplace, marketplace, and community. What is fantastic is that UN Women has developed many tools, education programs. So again, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. What we are doing is actually giving it the context into the jewelry and watch industry and encouraging companies to sign the Women Empowerment Principles and start what we call their activation plan. And if they already have signed the Women Empowerment Principles, we say, well, you have activated it. Now you have to accelerate it because we want front runners. That program has been very successful. We also have launched materials. I invite you to go to the website on some of the case studies we've done. The program I'm particularly proud of, but again, with humility, is what we're doing on gender-responsive procurement. If I ask people that are listening to this podcast and you have a business, do you know how much you're buying from women entrepreneurs? Or do you know how much you're buying from entrepreneurs, but that really embed strong gender policies into their business strategy? Many companies do not collect that data. And if they have that data and their gaps, they don't really have strategic programs into place. Of course. And so we did a pilot with a number of companies on gender-responsive procurement. We were one of the first to test a tool with UN Women. Now we know the gaps, Lauren, and we're actually now working together with a number of beautiful brands and suppliers to advance the program. And I think once we have the output, we will, of course, share it with the wider industry because yes. That's also the principle. And then on the third areas, you have the Women Empowerment Principles, gender-responsive procurement. And the third point we're working on is on an accountability mechanism. So if we want to move the needle, we need to have data into place on, you know, what does it mean to be strong on gender? We've been working with UN Women on developing a stronger accountability mechanism. The idea came in Davos in January this year, and our target is January 2026 to come up with proposed accountability mechanism. And this accountability mechanism is actually the result of multi-stakeholder consultation across industries where we've asked big companies, smaller companies, okay, how are you measuring gender? How are you measuring some of the key topics? Then we mapped all the indicators across many different frameworks. We looked at it from an investor's perspective also. So we looked at how financial communities look at this topic. And we're bringing all this information together now to propose a new accountability mechanism, because that could really help move the needle. If companies have data, we know where the gaps are and we can work and focus. These are three areas where we're working. And I think the objective can be that we can then go to other organizations and associations so that we can really start with education. Because the first thing is to educate, Lauren. Not enough people are aware of bringing gender as a priority into business strategy. At the end of the day, the consumers are diverse. We know that 90% of at least jewelry is influenced by women. We see watch brands changing some of their models. It's a very important priority for our industry. We need action.
When actioning these initiatives, especially women empowerment principles, how can leaders inside the company, how can they learn to activate and create more of that change inside? Maybe they're listening and want to bring this idea to their company. What can they do to bring that change?
First of all, Lauren, they should look at signing the Women Empowerment Principles. It's a commitment. Ask their CEO. We can put the link in there. It's important when you start a journey that there's a commitment, but then you have to move from commitment to action. And that will take time because you will need an engagement into the company because you will want everyone to be involved. This is part of the cultural transformation of an organization. And there it will be important that you create a small group of people, the believers, you know, believers, change agents across business functions. And you can look at what are we already doing. For example, with UN Women, there's an assessment where you can look at online. It will give you results and it will tell you gaps. Then you can start building your plan. For those listening, please do not hesitate also to reach out to us. You can go to our website and we can send materials. We can send you the education models that we've done. We can bring you into contact, I think, with some of the teams working on these topics. But I think it starts to go to your leader and say, can you kindly sign the Women Empowerment Principles? It's an important topic. Get your board involved. If you're a family business, go to the owners and ask them.
I'd love to bring more spotlight onto Watches and Jewelry Initiative 2030. There's so much you guys have done within these last couple of years. For those outside of the industry who haven't heard of WJI 2030, it's more than just an initiative, it's a movement. Because when this idea for co-founding of WJI started to come into play, what led you into the role of executive director?
I was very lucky, Lauren, when I was asked to join the Watch and Jewelry Initiative 2030. And this is actually in July, this was 3 years ago. It was a unique opportunity because everything in my career came together into this initiative's philosophy. Eh? Because for those of you that do not know the initiative, so the Watch and Jewelry Initiative 2030 was co-founded 3 years ago, officially by Maison Cartier, delegated by Richemont, and the Caring Group. So as an initiative, asking companies to commit to three interconnected pillars, climate resilience, preserving resources, where we are talking about biodiversity and nature, and inclusiveness. So we really ask companies to go on the journey and to action and accelerate on these three topics. The philosophy is to help advance the industry with humility and work together in the wider ecosystem of the industry, but to go deeper into certain topics. For example, no one had developed a nature roadmap for the industry. We were the first to do so to work in multi-stakeholder consultation, you know, with WWF, Human Rights Watch. We went to the World Business Council for Sustainable Development, SBTN, so many organizations to really develop this roadmap. And this is an ongoing pathway. We want companies to understand, Lauren, the importance of seeing nature as business resilience and the dependency of nature, to understand how you build your nature roadmap as part of your business strategy. This is a very new topic. It's like where climate was 20 years ago. This is now new. And we want to be a pioneer in education, in collaboration, in bringing solutions to the table. We also launched a full digital tool with ESG Book in London, really on helping companies not just get documents right, but really help them build their pathways to have management systems and to get data points aligned with evolving regulations. Because what I think I also see, Lauren, is the regulations have become so complex. Yeah. Originally, we saw sustainability focused on the S side, on the social side. But today, climate and nature is very scientific, it's very technical. So how can we help companies really build solid pathways and look at the opportunity of collective action? Because, you know, no one can do that alone. If you think about decarbonization, for most brands, it's scope 3, it's their suppliers. How can a small supplier do this? They need capacity building, support. It's building that ecosystem, testing the waters, learning, and then
laying the foundation for the next 10, 15 years in the making. It's laying down a solid foundation, bringing in the right people and resources. And again, too, it's something to highlight is WJI, you guys work with such a broad scope of stakeholders. You're working with government, industry bodies, with brands and companies in the luxury industry. And it's having know-it-all to navigate a lot of these conversations and be able to go in there, ask the right questions, get the right data, synthesize it, and be able to share it in a way that a smaller independent brand can bite on it and be able to run with it and build their company. Whereas when it comes to making, you know, major decisions internally on your team, what's some principles that help guide you or help steer you in the right direction?
Well, I think first of all, for the initiative, governance has been key from the start. We built a robust governance model. And I must say, Lauren, allow me to really say with gratitude that I have a fantastic board. A very diverse board. If you look at our board, and you can see it on our website, who's part of it. So, of course, you have Mr. Cyril Vigneron, former CEO of Cartier and chairman of Cartier Philanthropy, and Mrs. Marie-Claire Daveux, you know, chief sustainability and institutional affairs of the Kering Group. Two, I think, exceptional people that on their own have so much expertise, which is great to help the direction of the initiative. And then you have this board with Urkel, the founding father of the Global Compact, Dr. Anino Mua, founder of 100 Women of Davos, Gaetano Cavalieri, president of SIPJO, or Bernadette from BGOP. So you've got these different brains and minds, and I think it's good to have a strong board that's ambitious. I like that. So they challenge me, and I challenge them back in a respectful, open, and constructive way. We build plans, right? We have this plan for ourselves to, you know, step by step to look at where we want to go on these pillars, but also how do we want to get there and with who? Who are the best partners? And for me, it's about excellence and value. When I talk to my team and we cannot do it in an excellent way and it does not bring value to members or the industry at large,
yes,
then we should not do it. Second principle is multi-stakeholder engagement. If we are bringing a solution to the table, we need a solid proof of concept, reviewed by the right experts, players, and that can be civil society, that can be at academic world, tested with certain policymakers, so that we, again, bring that value. One example, Lauren, we've been working on the complexity of the CSDDD. This is this European legislation. We see that companies are struggling on the concept of double materiality and on the linkage between human rights due diligence and environmental due diligence. We've been working with experts to help companies understand better, you know, give them tools, so that they themselves also can perform better and de-risk and find opportunities. So I think that principle of added value. And then I think for me, absolutely the principle of collaboration, not reinventing the wheel. When people ask me, are you going to start a new standards body? This was the original question that I always would get because I came from the Responsible Jury Council. No, we are here to work together with anyone that wants to work together with us to advance the industry. All of us have to put our ego down, hold hands, and I think unite to protect the integrity of the industry. We need a unified voice because we don't want to disrupt the consumer. That's why I get very annoyed when I see discussions between lab-grown versus natural. It's a consumer's choice, and whatever claims we're making need to be substantiated. Stop this fight. This is really not good. If I look, for example, within my board, I have Pandora. I also have Swarovski as a very active member. They're fantastic companies. They're contributing. We're doing now work with them on circularity. Let everyone breed. Give everyone opportunities. Let the industry learn as a collective.
I love that very much. And two of the principles that you mentioned was, you know, you want to have that excellence and value. So if you're not going to do things, one, excellent, or two, do them in a way where it brings long-term value to yourself or multi-stakeholders, don't do it at all. And second, one of the most important, most critical right now is the collaboration. I think innately, humans, I feel, have our natural state is to connect and collaborate. It's to go far and to make a really big impact. It's learning how to collaborate, which WJI does extremely, extremely well, is, you know, taking this unified vision and helping bring people together in this initiative to move forward. So no matter where you are, where you come from, it's bringing in that energy of inclusivity and teaching people to collaborate. How can we build things together? How can we create things together to help this next generation thrive and flourish, I think is definitely the role that another role that a lot of the leaders must take on today.
Yes, and I think also learn from other industries. Yeah, let's look at living wages. You know, we think about decent labor, human rights. This is a very complex topic. Thanks to fantastic work from Maison Chanel or the Kering Group, we have really connected to other industries to see where are they in that work? What can we learn from some of it? And you know, I've been at round tables listening in. I've been speaking to other industries, chief sustainability or chief compliance to understand the approach. And then working also closely, for example, with the ILO to understand, okay, you know, what is the further methodology? What is the further approach? And I'm actually quite proud that a number of our companies have gone through this whole education pathway on living wage. So we have really an education pathway on methodology and approach. And now we're actually doing a gap analysis and looking at further action plans. This is something, of course, that requires time, touches the bottom line. But of course, it brings also dignity to people when you have, you know, decent wages and a good model for that. So it all takes time. Inaction is not an option. We just have to start doing it. And I think the philosophy of the initiative is we do it the right way. We do it step by step. We use the right methodology, test the waters. And if we're confident, we can then indeed bring it to the wider industry.
It's not one size fits all.
Exactly.
It can be very prescriptive. Yeah. There's a lot of culture coming into play, local politics, and as you live, it's learning from the past and not making those same mistakes. Iris, you've had the experience to work with so many types of people across the world. What have you observed about how different cultures approach sustainability, whether that's from a climate and nature perspective, whether that's a social perspective in the luxury space today?
Sustainability as a concept has tremendously evolved. Originally, when I came in, that topic, so early 2000s. So imagine this is almost 25 years ago. Lauren, I'm turning 55 in a couple of months. So, and I was 30 when I started in the field. It was, you know, it was often very philanthropic and very, and sometimes disconnected to the core business and very much focused on the social community side. I saw a change over time due to pressure of regulations that actually, you know, companies are responsible for their direct operations, their wider connections on due diligence. And that's where bigger responsibility comes towards their suppliers and looking at the whole value chain, even service providers. So there's this huge scope that they need to manage. And so I saw it coming from a very small ecosystem now to a very bigger ecosystem. And I think the role of luxury brands there is that luxury brands are legacy brands, right? For me, a real luxury brand is a legacy brand. It's about exceptional craftsmanship, highest integrity, exceptional creativity. It's pure emotion. It's about ultimate beauty. For me, that's true luxury and longevity, right? It will stay over time. That's the beauty of legacy brands. It's that long-term thinking because a brand that stays and continues to live that long life. If I think about my grandmother, who gave my at 18 years old, my first leather handbag from Delvaux, and now part of the Richemont Group, I still have, I protect it. It's very special to me. My point is about longevity that you need to protect. And we have, of course, companies in different sizes, different maturity stages. Brands are leading the way. A lot is happening in the middle of the supply chain, thanks to some pressure of certain mining houses. But there's so much to do with small enterprises. That's not a criticism. We need to bring them on the journey. And that will require education, that will require practical guidance, that will require a lot of hand-holding, which is fine. But we do need to bring them into that direction because we have a collective responsibility. At the beginning of the podcast, if you have a beautiful product, every component has to be exceptional. How it has been made, the positive or negative impact it has had, all of that is very carefully managed. That's a huge responsibility for us as an industry because we are an industry of emotions. We need to work together to bring everyone on the journey.
Yes. Creating symbols of luxury in the sense of something. You look at an object and it's able to transfer down generations. And it's a symbol of love, of lasting legacy. And it holds such weight. And luxury should be passed down for generations, like an heirloom, not just jewelry or heirlooms. It could be really anything. Connecting to those values on what that product represents. It's the brands and the people stepping up, even smaller independent brands. Small brands have the luxury of being nimble and move quickly. Iris, to close off this sustainability conversation, what do you believe is a shared human thread across the diverse communities or stakeholders that you work with? And what's something that you see that can unite us in building more of this responsible future together for the industry and beyond?
First of all, Lauren, it's a common thread is climate, eh? Climate. And nature, the climate and nature crisis that we are all experiencing, you know, from fires in California, Sardinia, Spain, the droughts, conflict. Unfortunately, since World War II, we've seen so much conflict and political uncertainty, never good for business, but which is never good for humanity. And I think we need to come back to core principles of humanity. That's key across industries. And I always think my grandfather was a soldier in World War II, and my grandmother, when she was writing letters to him, I still have some of her letters. And one of the words that always came back into all those letters was, I hope to see you. I hope the war will end. I hope you will come back safely. For me, personally, I think hope is very important. I think we all have to continue to be hopeful and be our best selves to influence our own scope every day in what we do. But at the same time, we must realize that we have to action now as individuals, as companies, as governments, because clearly, you know, Mother Nature will react and she's already reacting, right? She's not happy and it's not good for business. Even if you take aside, you know, if you would say, well, Iris, you're too soft, too philanthropic, you know, blah, blah, blah. No, Lauren, the reality of business resilience. If you have droughts, fires, this has a big impact on your supply chains, on people, on so many topics. So there's a big cost of not taking care of nature and climate. And then I think the respect for people and talent, we need to see for our industry that we continue to attract young people to learn the craftsmanship of jewelry making and watchmaking. It's art. If we think about designs, this is art. How can we connect the hearts and the souls of young people to say, this is an industry of purpose. This is really where I want to work. I want to bring my heart to this industry and I want to bring my life to this industry. If we don't have anymore the heart and the passion from mining to manufacturing, designing to the execution to retail, there will be no markets. That's a collective responsibility. I think individually in our behavior, how we behave. But I think also as an industry to be really united and work hard
to
make this happen.
And I think too, the jewelry industry has a good shot at becoming that example for other industries. It's creating legacy in the sense of people and the impact on people. It's not just about the products or aesthetics. It's about the legacy. Mm-hmm. Have you found a link between women's empowerment rights and climate crisis happening today?
Well, that's a fantastic question, Lauren. The climate crisis is not gender neutral. I'll give you an example. In many regions, when a climate crisis is hit, what happens is, you know, women who normally take the traditional roles of securing food, water, fuel for their families, but these resources become scarce due to climate crises, they will have to travel farther to get, for example, to get water. They'll have to move their families. Children will leave school because of the climate crisis. And this has a vicious circle, right, on the increased burden on the mothers and the children who don't go to school. If children don't go to school, it's often the girls, again, that are left at home to take that burden. And I think an important fact, the Gender Snapshot 2024 report indicates that by 2050, climate change may push up to 158 million more women and girls into poverty. This is, I mean, unacceptable. And in the worst case climate scenario, an additional 236 million women and girls could be pushed into food insecurity by 2050. I mean, how can we allow this to happen? And when we link that then to children's rights, is that that's increasingly worrying, Lauren, because if you think about children, they are also disproportionately impacted by climate due to their unique development characteristics. So, for example, children under five bear 88% of the global disease burden associated with climate change. The effects on their development, health, education, and well-being will be lifelong and irreversible. This cycle has a huge impact. This is why the initiative is so important. We want companies to understand that you cannot put climate in a box and nature and inclusiveness. It's interconnected, and we need to think together about collective just transition plans to advance that agenda.
I'm curious to know where the most impacted communities are. I would imagine in the producing countries, in Africa, in Botswana.
You've got great examples, Lauren. You've got, for example, nation building in Botswana. I think what happened there is fantastic. This is really a model of development. If we could scale the Botswana model, that would be great. But if you think about, for example, colored gemstones, that's 90% artisanal. So informal, you need a systematic approach. So when companies are doing due diligence, they need to understand, you know, what are the risks in that region? What are the facts? And that's why it's great to have data. And that's why I appreciate working with you and looking at the data of UNICEF. Look at those issues in countries where you're sourcing and connect the dots and work together with other companies to build stronger programs. But that's the theory, right? Because, you know, you've got governments, and often if we think about conflict affected and high risk areas, this is very challenging. And I think often companies do not want to do this because of the risk. And that's where I believe it's important as an industry to take step-by-step actions, to work multi-stakeholder, to look at some proof of concepts that are scalable. Because it's a responsibility. It won't happen overnight, but we need more traceability. We need more transparency, because I'm very confident that the consumer of today already, but the consumer of tomorrow will ask much more questions. And I think it's a good thing. How is this piece of jewelry contributing to development? You know, I always believe, Lauren, the first thing people look at is beauty. Do they like the design, the craftsmanship? But then they will ask more questions, but how is it made? Where are the diamonds coming from? Where are the colored gemstones coming from? What impact does it have on nature? Legislation is going into that direction too, because we should not forget, originally legislation focused very much, Lauren, on management systems. Okay. A company needs to have decent management systems, on responsible business practices, human rights, labor, on decent wages, environment, etc. If you look at the legislation, everything is going to product data, product passport, traceability. If you want to make a claim, it needs to be substantiated on your product. Yes. So you need data. This is a complete different model, which requires data that often doesn't exist. It will take time to build that credible data and set up, you know, those proof points. So we have a lot of work. Well, very exciting, and it gives opportunities.
Think about shopping for a handbag, or maybe it's a perfume, or maybe it's a piece of jewelry. Being able to scan something and being able to track and trace, step to the supply chain and get to know, like, oh, like, how was my gemstone cut? Where was my stone sourced? Like, how is this gold made and manufactured and casted, I think is a beautiful journey to share with the collector. So, Iris, moving on, when you think about the future of responsible luxury, what are some possibilities and opportunities that excite you the most?
The future of luxury is about exceptional craftsmanship. exceptional people with passion and purpose. It's about art and innovation. It's about responsibility, a collective responsibility, accountability. It's about stepping up and advancing more than ever on transparency. And it is really about meaningful purpose and contributing to dignity for all.
Yeah, I think we find ourselves in a challenging time, no matter where you live in the world. Something I've always believed in, when you're in the middle of chaos, there's always that seed of grace and seed of opportunity to bring out values and inspire. People see the light in you and you help light others. I see industries becoming more conscious, waking up to the world, waking up to these issues, having more people aware of these things and owning these values is a good path forward.
I think the future of our industry is about absolute inclusive leadership. Where are the women at the top? Yes, step by step, we're seeing more women in leadership roles, but how can we embed leadership across the functions in a systematic way? How can we prepare a diverse talent pool? And, you know, allow me to say there are so many fantastic women already in our industry. And just to name a few, I have deep respect for Catherine Regnier, the CEO of Van Cleef & Arpels, but also the CEO of Boucheron. You have already a few of these C-suite people, but, you know, we need more women leaders at the top. We need more women leaders across business functions. That requires a systematic approach. And when I talk about inclusive leadership, I would also say that it's super important to bring in talent from diverse backgrounds. How can we attract young people from underprivileged families and communities to give them the opportunity to work in the luxury industry and to contribute to that aspiration? And again, that's something we need, a systematic approach from education at school to different learning pathways, to internships, to mentorship programs that work. So
we have young leaders listening to this podcast today. What's something that you would tell a young leader who wants to make a meaningful difference, but they have this complex of perhaps feeling like they don't belong yet? What would you say to that young leader?
You belong. You belong. Say that every morning in the mirror to yourself. You belong. You can step up. Believe in yourself. Be bold. Look at programs, find connections, work hard, believe you can do it, connect yourself with many different voices, people to support you in mentorship. And it's something what I've always been trying to do, Lauren, is every year I try to mentor a few young people, listening to them, sometimes opening a door, telling them to go and meet some other colleagues of mine that I believe could be better value on a certain topic. So that one, they don't feel alone, because sometimes you might feel lonely, get discouraged or lose confidence. It's giving someone a safe container to grow. We all have a unique role in leadership roles to help open doors for others. If we had to wait longer for us to get doors open, that's not an excuse. We need to do more now. That period of time for someone to evolve becomes
short.
Yes, and
it's them open doors physically, but also helping them open doors within themselves too. Like you said,
exactly.
Very powerful.
I love that.
Iris, as we are coming to a close, what I love about these podcasts is it's like a digital archive in sort of a way. And it's something that, you know, these podcasts are going to be out in the digital world living years from now. And it's something so beautiful to come back to. With that, well, I want to ask you, what does legacy mean to you? And what do you hope your impact will be in the long run?
Huh. Difficult question, Lauren. I would say, as a legacy, I hope to leave behind the fact that people remember me as someone who tried her best to advance the industry, tried her best to connect the industry, to protect the integrity of an industry, but most important, that I touched many people's hearts and minds on my way and inspired them to action and contribute to the sustainability agenda, and especially for women and gender. That's a topic that I've been an advocate on since early 2000 for the industry, because I would only meet men. I was actually quite surprised on that. And that's where I thought, Iris, you need to help advance a woman and integrate that topic as a strategic pillar into a business strategy.
Well, I think someone like you is an engine for growth, helping build connections with women, luxury and sustainability. You're well respected in the luxury and sustainability space. And it takes, you know, to build that reputation, that trust takes very, very long time. And if you ask me, I feel like you've built your legacy already on that, because if you ask anyone who's met you, they would say those things about you.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe, Lauren, one more thing, because, I mean, my son will not be happy, yeah? that my legacy also, of course, I want to be remembered as a mother, you know, as a cool mother to my son. Yes, as a loving daughter to my parents, a loving sister to my brother, and a loving partner. That's equally important. Yes, balance with family is super important. Also, as a leader, it's very important that you have a safe space at home also. That you have a home to come back to, that you have people and friends who love you, that can help you advance, or if you have a bad day, listen to you. You need that. You need to be nurtured. We're on this planet to love and to be loved. That's why we need to love this planet so much and take care of it.
I think that's one of the most powerful things out of this conversation, having that community at home, supportive people around you to love you at the end of the day, no matter what happened at work, and support you and build you up. No matter what, unconditionally. So I love that very much. Beautiful. Well, Iris, thank you so much today for your presence, the purpose, and the incredible work you've been building in the industry. I hope to see you again soon next time you're in New York. Before we go, where is the best place for our listeners to find you and support the work you're doing with WJI 2030?
I would invite them to go to the Watch and Initiative 2030 website. Follow us on LinkedIn, and you can always send me a message through LinkedIn or the website to my incredible team. So happy to
and I'll be sure
feedback.
To include those in the show notes below. Iris, thank you. I look forward to the next time you and the team are in New York. We have our Climate Week dinner coming up this year, so it's going to be a very, very good
one. I'll be there, Lauren. I'll be there. And thank you so much for the opportunity. It's been really, really wonderful
to talk to you.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap on today's episode of Responsible Luxury. I want to thank Iris for sharing all of her insights on what it really means to lead with purpose in today's world. Leaders listening today, Iris has shown us that responsible luxury isn't just theory. It's daily choices grounded in humility, collaboration, and accountability. Here's what I hope you took away. One, trust is the new currency, and leadership today is all about collaboration, not control. If you're running a company, building a brand, or shaping the future of luxury, the time to act is now. This is more about than ticking ESG boxes or talking about impact. It's about setting the standard for what's possible in business and in culture. And the leaders who move first will be the ones who define this next decade of growth. If this conversation resonated with you, please share it with your team, a friend, with anyone who needs to hear it, because change in this industry doesn't happen from the sidelines. It happens when we step up and we lead. I'm Lauren Petrovic, and this is a Responsible Luxury Podcast. Until next time, keep building with purpose, leading with vision, and pushing what's possible.